This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 48 was recorded on February 2nd, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Renowned author Jack Schwager is best known for his Market Wizards book series, but he also wrote the definitive book on futures trading more than three decades ago. Jack just released a brand new edition of that book, and we'll discuss its contents in detail in today's featured interview.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, the S&P 500 took a pounding earlier this week with the S&P futures dropping down to that 2262 level on Tuesday. But by the time we taped this show on Thursday afternoon, we're back up to the 2276 level. What's going on with the S&P 500?
Well, it's all about a reaction to Donald Trump's first immigration policy, then firing the acting attorney general and so forth. And frankly, I think what's happening is everybody's freaking out on emotion. And this is exactly the same thing that you see when a war starts. Everybody's like, oh my God, a war is breaking out. Quick, sell everything while we still can. And then after the emotion kind of wears off and they start thinking with their brains again, it's like, wait a minute, wars are always inflationary, and wars result in increased government spending on defense, and wars result in increased demand for raw material. Oh, wait a minute, this is bullish. Let's start buying again. And I think what you're seeing here is the people who feel very strongly against Donald Trump's policies, which does not appear to be the majority of the country, interestingly, but the people who are offended by this immigration policy are deeply offended, and they're freaking out. So that caused this plunge. It's no surprise to me that it's starting to retrace. And the thing you have to keep in mind here, folks, is it doesn't matter. No matter how offended you are, how racist or wrong you think this immigration policy is, the question you have to ask is, yeah, but what does that have to do with corporate earnings and the stock market? If we're going to adopt racism as a national policy, it's not necessarily going to hurt the stock market, even if it's something that a lot of people disagree with. Now, in the case of the NASDAQ plunge on Monday, that was more specific. That was specifically about the H-1B visa rumor, which was just a rumor on Monday. Since then, there's been a little bit more that's been leaked out. It looks like an executive order is coming. As someone who used to run a software company, I have a fair amount of background with this. So let me explain what is an H-1B visa for some of our listeners who don't know. It has to do with importing cheap labor from other countries. Let's suppose you've got some super smart guy sitting in India. He's got two PhDs in computer science. He's super smart, but he's working for $2 an hour in India because the economy there is just awful. So a tech company, a software company in Silicon Valley, wants to hire that guy. And basically what they do is they sponsor him. If he comes to work for that company that sponsored him on the H-1B visa, he can't just quit the next day and go work for somebody else. It's almost like an indentured servant thing in the sense that for the duration of that visa, he can only work for that employer, and they negotiate lower than market rates. So it is a way to hire offshore labor for technology companies and so forth, and get them at a cheaper cost than you would have to pay for an American. Now, in the past, that's been perceived as a great deal for all parties involved until you consider it from a protectionist perspective. The tech company gets a talented resource for less money than they would have to pay otherwise, and that guy in India gets a job where if he can just send a few $100 a month home to his family in India, that's huge money in India. So it's a great deal for everybody, unless you consider it from the standpoint of Donald Trump, who seems to see it as a case of stealing a job that should have gone to an American worker. Now, if there are American workers who need to protectionism in order to protect their jobs, honestly, I don't think it's Silicon Valley software engineers, and I say that as an ex-software entrepreneur. If there are people who have plenty of opportunities for employment and don't need protection, it's software engineers in Silicon Valley. But I think that that was what was driving the NASDAQ plunge. What has subsequently come out is that Mr. Trump is saying, that he wants the H-1Bs to be issued only for what they were originally intended for, which is the very best and brightest. The idea of the H-1B program, I would have to agree, although I disagree with the policy personally, I do have to agree with one part of it, which is this business about how it supposedly imports the smartest people around the world into the United States. That's nonsense. Now, my knowledge of this is 20 years old, but my experience with it was basically, you want to sponsor somebody in an H-1B, you've got to write a check to a law firm that specializes in that, and they'll get the guy approved because they know what the government's looking for. I don't think it really did anything other than just to import cheap labor. It was not filtering out only the best and brightest, and what Mr. Trump seems to be saying is he doesn't want these visas given out to give away jobs to offshore labor and take that job away from an American unless that person really and truly is the best and the brightest, and I would have to agree that the H-1B visa program didn't really work that way, at least in my experience with it, although it was supposed to. As far as I'm concerned about equities, though, I'm staying on the sidelines. I think that a lot of really smart people here have been saying, look out below, you know, the world's about to end. Is that really going to happen? It's hard for me to say. I think that this market has been overvalued for a very long time, but it keeps marching higher. On a technical basis, we don't have enough of a down move. This, you know, everybody's freaking out. We moved all the way down to 2262. Oh my gosh, 30 whole points below the all-time high. That's not enough to say that the trend has changed here. So right now, we have a strong uptrend in play. I think that's crazy. I think it could reverse into a strong downtrend, but I think I've been wrong about that enough times before that I don't want to put on a directional trade. If I was going to bet on anything, it would be to say that I don't think we're going to stay flat here. I don't think the market's just going to level off and stay at 2275 or whatever it is right now for the next 6 months. I think we're probably going to move substantially higher or lower. That happens to play very nicely into a question that we received from one of our listeners this week who asked me, Patrick, with respect to the discussions we've been having about options, to cover the topic of index straddles. And I know that that is very pertinent to the view that I just described. So let's table that for now. But in our post-game segment after today's feature interview, I'd like to come back and get your perspective on how we might use option straddles in order to take advantage of the scenario that I just described in the market. As far as the other comment that I'll make about equities, we have seen this week that Donald Trump is not at all afraid to be bold in the face of very strong opposition to criticism. He's not afraid to tell the president of Mexico, apparently, as is reported that he did on Wednesday, that, look, you're scared of your drug cartel, but I'm not. I'm going to send the, or I don't know if he threatened or offered to send U.S. military forces in to deal with the so-called bad hombres in Mexico. But Donald Trump is not afraid to take bold positions that cause great criticism. What we have not seen yet is Donald Trump playing his first card against ISIS. So far, all that's happened is he's quietly asked the chiefs of staff to give him a plan, how he intends to execute a plan, what stance he's going to take. I don't know. Nobody knows but Donald Trump. But one thing I will predict is whenever it happens, fasten your seatbelts, because I don't think it's going to be tame in its tone. And I think that that could potentially have an effect on all markets, not just equities.
Very good points there, Eric. Now, I want to just move on to the U.S. dollar index, which certainly has not stopped the pullback that we've seen over the last many weeks. Right now, we've seen a low print around that 99.19 level earlier Thursday morning. Does your outlook on the U.S. dollar change in any way?
No, it really doesn't change. And the reason I say that is it's doing exactly what I think it should be doing and what I would expect. We saw the dollar recovering very nicely. It had moved very nicely above 101 just minutes before Donald Trump's first comment that Germany was abusing the currency system and was supposedly some kind of currency manipulator. And it took a nosedive on that. Then Trump made more comments about China and Japan on Tuesday, another nosedive. No surprise that those things happen, because when the President of the United States speaks, people listen. But again, Trump's words say he wants a lower dollar. That's causing an immediate knee-jerk panic reaction. All of Trump's policies are very dollar bullish. He hasn't announced any policy that would be dollar bearish. He's just jawboning the market lower. What would you expect to happen in that kind of situation? Well, as I said last week, I think that there's a pretty good technical support around 99. And if it stays above 99, I'm not too worried. What would you expect if the President of the United States is talking it lower? Well, you'd expect the weak hands to panic, which they did, and it should sell off to its technical support level, which it did, and then it should start to recover, which it has. So I think that what we're seeing here is very much in line. We're still in a 99 handle, but I think it's, what, 99.78 as we're speaking now on Thursday afternoon, and appears to be starting another recovery. The big caveat, though, is if Mr. Trump continues to jawbone the dollar index lower, as we start to get below that technical support level at 99, do the buyers come pouring in because that's where technical support is? Or do we come to a situation where this admittedly overcrowded trade starts to lead to a panic to the exits as soon as somebody monkey hammers the market below 99? Definitely a panic could, in theory, get out of hand. But frankly, that function of panics getting out of hand, where selling begets more selling because stop orders are being hit, that's all something that really gets ugly in illiquid markets. When we're talking about the U.S. dollar index, where currency markets are already one of the deepest and most liquid markets in the world, and the dollar is probably the deepest and most liquid currency in the world. Even in that scenario, I don't even think stops getting hit and so forth is really going to do it. So I'll be surprised, certainly, if we see a big trip substantially below 99, particularly if we got below 97.50. I would say, wait a minute, okay, a panic is in play. Maybe it's time to get out of the way of that. But I would still be looking for a buying opportunity once that plays out, because I don't think that we've seen anything that's actually dollar bearish. We've just seen a lot of dollar down rhetoric coming from President Trump.
Now, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. That West Texas Intermediate crude has been fluctuating up and down around that 53 level for over 2 weeks. And finally, we've seen some strength up to the $54 level here Thursday morning. Is that a new breakout in oil?
Well, even the 54 level, 54 spot 34, I think, was the high on Thursday morning. That didn't last, and we're back down to a 53 handle on Thursday afternoon as we're taping the show. So I don't think it's a new trend. As far as inventory, we had on Wednesday a massive 6.5 million barrel build on inventory, far exceeding any analyst's expectations. Cushing, Oklahoma was a drawdown, 1.2 million barrels, but there's still over 85% of capacity in Cushing. Gasoline, 3.9 million barrel build on inventory, and that's on the back of 2 weeks in a row of 6 million plus inventory builds. So what are we up to in just the last 3 weeks alone? Something like 16 million barrels of gasoline added to inventory, another 1.6 million barrels of distillates added to inventory this week. These should all be very bearish. I'm actually surprised that the market's holding up as well as it has. I don't think there's a whole lot of big events in the short term to talk about, but a couple of longer time horizon issues hit my radar this week. Some of these are a little bit complex because they involve some of the mechanics of how futures markets operate. So I'll tell you what, Patrick, let's do this. Let's wait until after the feature interview with Jack Schwager. That way our listeners will have a better perspective on futures trading and some of the more substantive content that I want to get into around what I see in the term structure of the crude oil market will make more sense at that point.
All right, Eric. And in the face of that dollar weakness, gold has actually been much stronger this week, testing that 1,227 level Thursday morning and now trading around that 1,217 level late in Thursday afternoon. What do you think is in store next for gold?
Well, I think that this rally maybe it's over, I'm not sure, about dollar weakness. We got down almost to that 99 level. Of course, who knows? Maybe we're going to get some more rhetoric out of Donald Trump, and gold's going to go higher, and dollar index is going to go lower. At the moment, I'm hoping that 99 holds in the dollar index. That would suggest that maybe we've seen as much as we're going to get out of this rally. So was 1227 the high? Is that going to be it? I don't know, but I'm kind of leaning towards that. Unless, of course, there is a panic in the dollar index and everybody jumps out of that trade at the same time. That could push the dollar index much lower and gold much higher. But I do think that is the outlier. The more likely scenario, if something is going to push gold higher, I don't think dollar index weakness is going to do it because I don't really see the dollar index weakness on the horizon. What I do see is Donald Trump being really outspoken. I mean, he told the president of Mexico, dude, you're a wimp. You're afraid of your drug cartels. I'm not afraid of them. I'm going to send my troops down to kick some butt and deal with the bad hombres. Now, my comments are based on what Zero Hedge has reported on this. I don't know whether Donald Trump politely offered help to the president of Mexico or actually said, you're afraid and I'm not, as Zero Hedge seemed to allude. If it really was that strong, I guess it doesn't surprise me given Mr. Trump's personality. But my point is, he's saying very bold things and he hasn't dealt with ISIS yet. If he takes such a bold stance and really says, okay, ISIS, we are going to kick butt. We're going to really do something strong and there's going to be, everybody's going to get freaked out about a big geopolitical scare. If that is potentially soon on the horizon, I think that comments like that around ISIS would be more likely than the dollar index weakness to push gold higher in the short term. So we'll see what happens there. The other thing, of course, to keep in mind about gold is the FOMC seems to be slightly weakening its stance. I don't think I mentioned this when we talked about the dollar index, but a lot of people were hoping that the FOMC in yesterday's announcement would at least reiterate a hint that, hey, March is a likely time for the next rate hike to happen. Well, they didn't do that. They've kind of gone hush on rate hikes. That leads a lot of people to think that March is an unlikely time for the next rate hike. And of course, if you're not seeing a hike in yields, then that's good for gold. So that may be helping us here too. So watch for more messaging from the FOMC. That's going to affect the gold market as well.
With that outlook on the FOMC, with the 10-year Treasury yields now hovering around that 2.5% level this week, anything new on your fixed income outlook?
No, not really. Definitely I still feel that the question of the year is whether or not the Treasury secular bull market is over. What happens with the dollar next is definitely going to have an impact. So I'm watching the dollar index. Again, a break below 99 and particularly a break below 97 would cause me to definitely take pause and say, wait a minute, the panic is on. Everybody's jumping off the same side of the boat here. The thing really, though, that's most likely to impact this, we need to see what happens with the FOMC. How they react to the president. We haven't really seen the reconciliation of Donald Trump rhetoric with Donald Trump actions. A lot of Donald Trump rhetoric that's very dollar bearish, a lot of Donald Trump policies that are anticipated that should be very dollar bullish. And as far as FOMC policy, we don't know how much the FOMC is going to be responsive to pressure from the president. These things are all yet to play out. So I'm kind of in wait and see mode, but I definitely think that this question is very important, and I'll be watching those key levels. I'm not sure who's right. Bill Gross says a move above 260 in the 10-year. That's what spells the game over for the bull market in treasuries. Jeff Gundlach says the magic number is 3%. David Rosenberg says the magic number is much more like 4%. I don't know who's got the magic number right, but I definitely think that the question is the most important question of our time.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Renowned author Jack Schwager is best known for the Market Wizards book series, but he also wrote the definitive book on futures trading, and that's the subject of today's interview. Please stay tuned after the interview as Eric and I will be back to talk about options trading strategies and how we can apply that to some of Eric's views that he expressed earlier today in the market wrap-up. Eric's interview with Mr. Schwager is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now as this week's special guest is renowned author Jack Schwager. Jack is probably best known as the author of the infamous Market Wizard series, which is a compendium of long-form interviews with the very most successful traders and investors on Earth. Jack is also the guy who wrote the Bible for futures traders. Now, back in my day, the Bible was a three-volume series known as Schwager on Futures. These days, the Old and New Testaments have been merged together into a single 700-plus page volume, and that new book is called A Complete Guide to the Futures Market. Our institutional listeners already understand the role that futures play in the global financial system. But for the benefit of our sophisticated retail audience, I'm going to begin by setting the stage with a brief introduction. Originally, commodity futures contracts were used to trade the things that we traditionally think of as commodities: wheat, corn, soybeans, cocoa, sugar, copper, crude oil, and so on and so forth. But about 20 years ago, the landscape changed. As financial exchanges became more competitive, the commodity futures exchanges realized that they had a significant leg up over the stock exchanges because they had vastly expanded trading hours, and also because commodity futures contracts allow traders to employ much more leverage than regulations allow stock traders to use. Suddenly, futures contracts were being used to trade financial instruments, and today everything from stock indices to interest rate products to foreign currencies can be traded on futures markets. And unlike the stock market, which is only open for 6.5 hours a day, most futures markets trade at least 23 hours a day. This gives the professional futures trader a huge leg up over stock traders. If there's an earthquake off the coast of Chile at 2 o'clock in the morning, the futures trader can put on a long trade on copper futures, anticipating that the earthquake may affect the copper mines in Chile, and they can do that the instant that the news is received. Or if they're sitting in Chile, they can do it the instant that their house starts shaking. The stock trader, on the other hand, would have to wait until the stock exchange opens the next morning. Now, this doesn't seem terribly important for most retail investors, but for hedge funds and prop trading desks and investment banks and so forth, it's very important to be able to trade at almost any hour of the day in order to have an advantage and basically beat the people that are in the other markets to the trade. So with that background in place, we're going to dive into futures market trading. But Jack, I think we have a responsibility to first address something that a lot of people frankly don't talk about, and that is that futures trading is not for everyone. There's a statistic out there about how a huge percentage of retail investors who open futures accounts wind up losing substantially all of their money within a year. When people ask me about futures, the first thing I tell them is a phrase that I've coined, which is, futures are like firearms. Nothing wrong with either one of them, but they're not toys, and you don't just start playing with them to try to figure out how they work. If you try to do it that way, you're going to get hurt very badly. You need to invest in your education first and really learn how these markets work. So let's start with who should consider getting involved with futures trading, and who should stay away from futures trading, and why?
Sure. Yeah, that's a very good point. And actually, I would draw a little bit of an analogy to traders in any sphere, including, let's say, stocks, for example. So as you mentioned, the reason stock traders don't blow up as much or are in danger is because they can only leverage 2-to-1, where futures traders can leverage 20-to-1, and it's that makes it a more lethal weapon. But novices are going to lose in both cases. Now, in the stock market, novices really don't know what they're doing. Will basically do worse than the indexes, and significantly worse than the professionals do a little bit worse than the indexes on average, because they're paying transaction costs. But speculators as a group will do substantially worse, because they will actually make decisions that are detrimental besides having to pay the additional transaction costs. And there's certainly been lots of studies done which show that people who trade their own account end up having a much worse return. Now, that's the damage that's done by people who don't really know what they're doing or have an edge in the stock market. In the futures, because of the extra leverage, if they don't know what they're doing, it can end up being more lethal, namely blowing out the account. So now, the general answer to that question is really the same for future traders and stock traders. And this is my standard response as far as it comes to trading in general. Basically, if you really don't have an edge, if you don't have the confidence that you have an approach that can really do better than in the stock market than indexes, or in a futures market net, being net profitable with reasonable risk control. If you do not have a methodology that you have confidence can do that, and you demonstrate through trading does over time gradually increment without excessive risk, if you do not fall into that category, you should not be trading. And then you're just best off either in stocks, putting it into an index or something like that, and in futures, putting it into maybe investing with some portfolio of selected professional CTAs. That would be the approach. You wouldn't want to trade yourself. So that's my general advice, is if you don't have the edge, you shouldn't be trading at all. And the best investment is really, like I say, in stocks, an index investment. However, I don't agree with the large group of academics who say nobody can beat the markets, and therefore you just always should best put your money in an index fund, and that's the right answer for everybody. Well, that's where I disagree. I think there are a small percentage of people who've done the work, who have the skill, who do have some edge, and can do better than the average, and can be net profitable in futures. And so if you fall into that category, then I think futures are an attractive vehicle because of their liquidity and their access to such a broad gamut of different types of markets.
Now, something that I learned from reading your Market Wizards books is this question of whether technical analysis or fundamental analysis is the best way to approach a market. It's not really even a matter of opinion. It's more like a religious war. In Market Wizards, you interviewed somebody like Jim Rogers, who refuses to even take any kind of technical charting seriously. You've got other super successful guys who say you cannot succeed unless you embrace technical analysis. So I know you've covered a huge amount of, I think I've 20 chapters or something in the new book just on the subject of technical analysis. Give us the quick overview, and I think you've got an entire chapter devoted just to the philosophical debate of technical versus fundamental. So give us the executive summary, including your own opinion on the topic.
Sure. Well, you have people like you mentioned, somebody like Jim Rogers, who's a long-term investor. The beginning of my interview with him for the original Market Wizards book was our arguing whether he was even a trader. He insisted that he wasn't. In any case, you have someone like him who looks at charts as mumbo jumbo, and you know, he might look at a chart to just see the price history, but that's data. He's not using any technical analysis or chart analysis. On the contrary, he feels that those approaches are a bunch of nonsense. And his line is I never met a rich technician. And then he pauses and says, unless you count those who sell their services. So he's quite cynical about technical analysis. Then you have other people like somebody else from the first Market Wizards book, say like Marty Schwartz, who spent a good part of his early career on the stock side, and said he lost money every year trading stocks. And then he got super, you know, then he got wealthy trading futures using technical analysis. So it really depends. And so the conclusion I draw from that is that neither fundamentals nor technical has the corner on the right approach. It really is not – either one can be used and has been used by individuals to be enormously successful. And in many cases, there are traders who successfully combine both of them. So it's not so much one is right and one is wrong. What is true is one is right for some people and wrong for others, and vice versa. So people have to discover really what works for them and which approach. So somebody like Buffett, you know, he's certainly not a technician, and I don't know if he ever looks at charts or whatever. He's staggeringly successful because he is a true fundamental investor, and he knows his investments inside out and carefully picks them, and has demonstrated that pure fundamental analysis can be a powerful tool. Somebody like who's a disciple of that type of approach, who I did interview in Hedge Fund Market Wizards, Joel Greenblatt, same thing. You know, great performance, but purely fundamental. So, and on the other hand, you have lots of people I've interviewed who have been purely technical and done tremendously well. So It's not one's right, one's wrong. One's right for you, one's wrong for you, you know, or in some cases, they both may have benefits. So each trader must find really what their approach is. It's going to be different for everybody, and both approaches are valid. And that's why I've covered both in this compendium. I end up with more material on technical analysis and chart analysis, because over the years, that's where I've evolved myself most, and that's where I felt I had the most, I could provide the most value.
Well, you're not kidding when you say you provide a lot there. I'm looking at the table of contents right now, and I see it looks like 9 chapters on chart analysis itself, and then 4 more chapters on the subject of how to apply that chart analysis to trading. So obviously, you think it's important to futures. We don't have anything close to enough time to dive into all of that, but give us just the high-level overview of what you cover on technical analysis, and in particular, what aspects of technical analysis are different for futures than for stocks.
Okay. So I guess what I would say would maybe differentiates my approach. I mean, there's tons of books out there. You can find lots of books out there on chart analysis and technical analysis. And, you know, so certainly mine is not unique in covering that topic. I'd say what's different about my approach of the subject, coverage of the subject, and I can't say it's category true versus every other book written on the subject, but versus a lot of other books, is that I try to approach it from a realistic, practical, market sense way, meaning that, you know, most books will basically say, oh, here's a head and shoulders. I'll show you a nice picture of head and shoulders, and this is what you do. You get the head and shoulders, and you complete the pattern. You go short, and everything's, you know, wonderful. Or here's a trend line, and you trade the trend line, and every time you come to the trend line, that's a great spot to buy. And if it breaks the trend line, you need to reverse your position. It just gives you the standard classical chart patterns and what is considered a confirmation of the pattern, and then you just trade with it, and you have all these illustrations, and it just seems to work beautifully. Now, the real world is not like that. Patterns will fail probably maybe more often than they work, and I know listeners are probably saying, well, hey, if that's the case, then what the hell use is any of this stuff? Well, the point is that you have to also consider how the market responds to a pattern. So first of all, in my book, I'll show lots of cases of patterns where they don't work. And the point is, and I also have a chapter which is very important, which is called, I think I call it the most important rule in chart analysis. But that essentially, that rule, and people listening, this following sentence or two is probably worth your whole listening to this whole interview. If that rule is basically patterns that fail are probably more reliable than patterns that work. So you have to be sophisticated enough and have enough practical sense that if a pattern is developing and it seems to give you a signal, and then the market reverses, that reversal can be more reliable for the opposite direction trade than the original signal. And using that is very, very critical. And also what's critical is combining it with risk management. So even though chart analysis does not have a super high percentage of being right in its patterns, if you combine the patterns with how the market responds to the pattern and using risk management to limit the losses when you're wrong and to protect profits along the way when you're right, then you can turn chart analysis into a very effective methodology. So that's kind of a short answer for it. I mean, that's not 20 chapters worth, but that gives you a flavor. And one more illustration maybe to make it a little more tangible. So I mentioned trend lines, since that's a good example too. So my personal feeling, and this is how my book will differ, I guess, from a lot of books on the topic. You know, almost all books will tell you, here are trend lines, here's, you know, use them, they're a tool. I'll basically tell you, in my experience, trend lines are broken much more often than they work. And what happens is they look good, and this is where people go wrong so often. They'll look at a chart, they'll draw a trend line, you know, and it looks like, oh, that's great, that really works well, and the market held each time it came down a trend line. What they ignore, and this is absolutely critical, is that they are using hindsight. going through real time, that is not the trend line that you would have drawn. And so what happens in real trading, in the real world, is you go along, a market develops, you have a trend line, let's say it's an uptrend, then the market breaks the trend line. Okay, then the trend line gets redrawn, and now there's another trend line, which is a little lower, and then that gets broken, and then, oh, well, now you could draw another trend line, which is a little lower. At the end of the pattern, you basically have a long trend line that seems like it worked, but that last trend line you only got to because you broke a number of other prior trend lines, and you would have basically lost money trading that technique. So I basically try to take a realistic approach of saying, here's the fact, trend lines are not particularly useful in the way they're conventionally used. They'll give you a tremendous amount of false signals. However, then I'll show how they can be used. And one way they can be used is when a trend line is broken, as trend lines are continually, even in good solid uptrends, that becomes a potential signal in that you can then look for the market to reverse back to go above that trend line breakout, showing a resumption of a trend. You can use that, say, as an entry signal. And that's just one example of an approach. So it's an approach I provide, one of many approaches of how to apply chart analysis. But the interesting thing about it is that it's really contrarian. I'm using trend lines really in a reverse way. I'm not telling you, you know, using a trend line to when it goes to trend line, that's where you buy. I'm telling you that if it's broken and then, let's say, comes back up, that might be a good entry point. So using the fact that trend lines get broken to your advantage, as opposed to following conventional wisdom, and you'll be stopped out all the time.
I want to pick up on that point about drawing trend lines on charts, because obviously you can't draw a trend line on a chart unless you've got a medium to long-term chart to draw it on. And there's something I think a lot of even professional traders who look at futures charts all day long don't understand, and that is that because futures delivery contracts are relatively short-lived, there's really no such thing as a long-term futures chart. Instead, the long-term charts have to be pieced together from shorter-lived individual contract charts. And the fact that there may be a difference in price between one delivery month and the next necessarily introduces an error, which I think a lot of traders, even professionals, don't understand is there, into these long-term charts. Now, I know you've got an entire chapter dedicated to this subject in the book. We're a little bit tight on time today, so we'll have to keep it moving. But very briefly, could you just explain the difference between a nearest futures chart and a continuous contract chart, and how important it is to understand the difference and know which one you're using and why?
Yeah, super critical. I mean, if you don't, then you shouldn't be trading. So many markets, let's say particularly ag markets is a good example. So you can have an old crop contract, let's say, trading at $4, and then the next contract is trading at $4.50, right? So nearest futures will just take when one contract expires, they'll then pick up the price of the next contract and so on. So now if a nearest futures chart, the old contract expires at 4, the new one's trading at 4.50, it looks like the market went up 50 cents, enormous move, you know, from 4 to 4.50. And in fact, that new contract, if on the first day of that rollover, if it goes from 4.50 to 4.40, on the chart it looks like you went from $4 to 4.40. It looks like the market went up 40 cents. Wow, that looks like a really strong market. In reality, the market went down 10 cents because all you did was switch at the contract rollover, and you didn't adjust for that big gap. So nearest futures does not adjust. So you'll get, anytime there's a gap, you'll get a distortion. You'll get what I would call phantom moves, price moves that didn't occur. It's just a consequence of the gap between contracts. Now, the way to solve that problem is to link together the contracts and adjust for the difference. So when you go to the new contract from 4 to 4.50, then you adjust all the past prices. So the past price was the previous day was 4.50 as well. Yeah, was the last day the previous price is 4.50, and so forth. But every time you come to a new contract, you make a cumulative adjustment. So the moves that are due just to the contract, they're not moves. I shouldn't say moves. The price differences that are due just to the price gap between contracts disappears because you adjust for that gap. So you're only reflecting true market moves. Now, that is called a continuous chart. You can think of it as like taking scissors and cutting the contracts and pasting the ends together. Now, that's a continuous futures chart. Now, the continuous futures chart will exactly reflect price movements. They will show what happens when you get out of one contract, get into the other contract. They'll exactly reflect your equity. They're absolutely what you should be using if you're testing trading systems. You can't use, if you use Nares futures, it'll be just garbage. So the continuous futures is the only type of representation that exactly mimics what happens to your equity and removes the distortions due to price gaps. However, what the continuous futures chart does not show is actual past price levels, because you can only accurately reflect the historical price levels of the individual contracts or the correct price moves. Once you make the chart reflect the price moves correctly, the levels will no longer match the historical levels. So there is a place for Nares futures, and that is long-term chart analysis. Because Nares futures does reflect actual price levels, you can use it to define support and resistance. And the key thing to understand is continuous futures market charts accurately reflect price moves. Nares futures accurately reflect price levels. If you're doing chart analysis, particularly short, long-term chart analysis, then you really should use both. If you're testing systems or looking at shorter-term charts, then you should basically just be using continuous futures.
And as you say, you can, using the wrong chart, get the exact opposite. You could have a tremendously bullish pattern on the Nares futures chart, and in reality, you should have been using the continuous futures chart that would have given you an incredibly bearish pattern. And I'm shocked by how many people don't understand that difference. So
yeah,
particularly
when professionals do it, it's inexcusable. It's beyond dumb. It's wrong. It's not a question of right or wrong. In fact, I'll give you a very simple example. We have very low interest rates now, but let's say we had higher interest rates, as we did in the past at some times. And you take a market like gold, where basically the price spread is strictly a function of interest rates predominantly. So if you have a situation, let's say, where gold's trading at 1,000, and assume there's a higher interest rate, and let's just make it simple and say, well, the contract goes every 2 months. But say every 2 months there's a price spread of $20. So over the course of a year, those price gaps will, because every time you switch, the new contract is $20 higher. Those price, $1,000, if the market went exactly sideways, the nearest year you would look like you're gaining $20 each time. You would look like $11.20. Or actually, I'm sorry, I said that backwards. If the market was going sideways, it was just $1,000, you basically would have lost $20 at every rollover, because you're going from the old to the new. So you would have lost $120, but the chart would look like you're unchanged. And in fact, if the gold went up a little bit in the cash, if it went to 1,000 to 1,010, it would look like you made $10 up per ounce, where in reality you'd have lost $110 an ounce. So your equity would not reflect your chart would not reflect what's happening to your equity. And the reason is because it's price moves that matter, not price levels. And as I said, if you're doing stuff like trade testing methodologies systematically, you absolutely have to use continuous. And if you're using the errors, you're just using the wrong numbers. It's like you're trying to analyze one currency using the prices denominated in another currency.
Briefly, before we move on to fundamental analysis, you dedicate quite a bit of the book to systematic trading and particularly analyzing systems and so forth. And I know a lot of people feel that in the world of commodity futures, where trending is more important, systematic trading is maybe more prevalent and more common than discretionary trading. Give us a little bit of perspective. Why the emphasis on systems?
Well, it's just one approach. And the good thing about systems and systematic analysis and trading on systems is, well, first of all, you can take a concept, and if you do it correctly, you can test, well, does that concept work? It's not seat of the pants. You can actually program it and test it and see, does that concept work? So it's useful for research and trying to find approaches that seem to work. It's also useful in that It can remove emotions, because if you come up with a system that has good return to risk and you have the confidence you've done it correctly, you could use that and just follow it totally and not have to be emotionally torn between trying to decide whether to buy and sell. You're just following your system. So those are the advantages. Now, the disadvantage is that you don't have direct control. There was a time where I liked the lack of getting rid of emotion in trading, but I found ultimately that it was I wasn't comfortable, because there were times I wanted to be tighter on risk management and so forth. So you have to kind of decide if it's right for you. But it is a useful approach for many traders, and if nothing else, for research. The one thing I would say before we leave the topic of systems, and one that I pay a lot of attention to in the chapters that you mentioned, is that it's really, really, really critical not to let hindsight bias your testing of systems. And that's where so many people go wrong. They test 1,000 different things, and sure, they'll find some that look really great, and then they'll think they have a great system. No, what they've got is, it's like they tossed 10 coins 1,000 times, and they took the one set where they came out 9 or 10 heads and thinking those are magic. No, they're just completely fooling yourself. So you got to use an approach of testing systems and developing systems that eliminates hindsight. And that's a lot of the material that I devote to systems, is in getting that point across and in outlining how you eliminate hindsight into the system development process.
You've got way more coverage on fundamental analysis than we could ever talk about in an interview today. Let's just touch on any nuances of it that are specific to futures trading as opposed to trading in general.
Okay, well, you know, there are different aspects of it. You know, some of it just a simple primer on supply demand. But what I try to do is also, again, come back to the real life aspect. So I think one of the first chapters I have a fundamental analysis is like fallacies, 14 fallacies about fundamental analysis. And I try to point out the common pitfalls that people fall into when they're using fundamentals. So we don't have time to go through that all, but I'll throw out one as an example. So say using fundamentals in a vacuum, right? People will say, oh, the fundamentals are really bearish. You know, let's say it's let's stick with an ag market, agriculture market. The crop's big, and their consumption isn't as high as they were expecting, and there's all these negatives and the weather is the weather's good, and prices are going down, and so fundamentals are really bearish, and so you feel really justified being short this particular market. Well, the point is, fundamentals are bullish or bearish, but not in a vacuum. By that I mean it depends on what the price level is. So, you know, if the wheat market is bearish at 6, is it still bearish at 550? Is it still bearish at 5? Is it still bearish at 450? At 4? At 350? At some point, those bearish fundamentals are discounted and over-discounted. So the mistake people make is just to view the fundamentals in a vacuum without considering relative to what price. So, and that is the reason why bottoms are always formed on when fundamentals are very bearish, and tops are always formed when fundamentals are very bullish. Why? Because the fundamentals by those points have already been discounted. So that's an example of a fallacy of how people use fundamentals in a wrong way, and one of the things you have to watch out for. So that's kind of an example of some of the stuff that I would cover.
I was also quite impressed when I looked at the new edition of the book to get an idea of what questions to ask you today. To be truthful, I just expected, you know, the old version of the book, the 3-edition thing in one volume. And actually, you've added quite a bit of new content since I first read the book. One of those areas that's near and dear to my own heart is spread trading, as well as options on futures, which I don't think you covered in the original series. And you've got, I don't know how many chapters, but quite a lot of on it here. So why are you adding coverage on spreads and options, and what do you cover there, and why is it important?
Sure. First, I should get the history right. The very first book I wrote was this book, A Complete Guide to Futures Market, in 1984. And that preceded the Market Wizards, first Market Wizards book by about 5 years. And so that book, you know, 1984 is quite old at this point. Then the books that you know, the three-volume set, was really a revision of that this original book that I wrote in 84. And in revising it, I ended up expanding it even more and ending up with three volumes and God knows, maybe like 1,800 pages. And I said I would never do that again. anyway, the publisher was after me to redo the book, but back to a one volume. So what I basically did is this is sort of a meshing of the original first volume and the three volume you're familiar with. Now, the original volume had spreads and options in it. When I read it into a three-volume series, I went into such detail, like single chapters on fundamental analysis for different markets. And so there's a whole 700-page book on fundamentals and so forth. So there was so much extra detail that topics like spreads and options didn't get covered because they didn't fall into the major three book topics, which were fundamental analysis, technical analysis, and managed trading. So the spreads and options didn't fit into any of those. So it fell out. So now in this book, when I've gone back to one volume, I've pared back like the fundamental section tremendously and managed trading and stuff. And I basically now gone back and now updated those original option and spread sections. So they now once again appear. So this volume is more the essence of the three-volume set, plus the things that were in the first volume that didn't get covered, and all of it, of course, revised and updated for the transitions over the markets. You know, we're now dealing with, you know, lots of financial futures, for example, markets that existed when I wrote the first book, say, for example, potatoes or something like that, don't exist anymore. So that's the point. So this book is really an up. The chronology is one volume to three volumes back to one volume. This is the current one volume version. Now, on the topic of spreads and options, spreads I think are really important. What a spread is, basically, you're trading either in a single market, intra-market. You might trade something like July corn, long July corn, short December corn. So what you're trading is you have a neutral position in the corn market, but you're betting that July corn, which is old crop, will gain in price relative to December corn, which is new crop. So that's an example of a spread. So it's a different type of trade. You're not betting on the price direction of the market, but the relative price change between different months. And we don't have time to go into why you would think one month is going more than the other, but that's the idea. What's particularly interesting is applying spreads to different markets. So you trade a spread between, say, you might want to be long gold and short silver, or short silver and long gold, or you might want to trade one currency versus another. You might want to be long soybean meal and short soybean oil, or the reverse trade. So you're now trading related markets, but betting that one related market will gain or lose relative to the other. And that provides a whole other universe of trade opportunities and chart patterns that you just don't see by looking at the outright market. And some of the best trading opportunities really come out of trading these relationships. And you get some very interesting charts that are evident in the let's say, in a gold-silver chart, which you wouldn't see if you're looking at just gold or just to see when you're looking at just silver. So spreads opens up a whole world, another world of trading. And options is also another methodology of trading. It allows you to, if you're looking for a big move, it allows you to take a position and risk less than you would, if you were right on the trade. And we don't have time to go into all the aspects, but in the options section, what I basically do is I take a single market at one point in time and show 35 or so different options, the option approaches, trades on that same market, so people can see the difference between all the strategies, what the profit loss profile of each strategy looks like for the exact same market situation. And I explain when you would use one versus the other.
And when you finish up even on spreads and options, we're at that point about 35 chapters into the book, but you still got almost 200 pages more that looks to me like mostly new material. So what else has been added to the book besides spreads and options?
Well, I think there's a good, maybe the biggest amount of new material comes from just trading. So it's drawn from all my Market Wizard interviews. So there'll be a chapter like on lessons from the Market Wizard. So I'm basically taking the things I learned from interviewing great traders and listing them as critical trading concepts. So there's about 3 or 4 chapters particularly devoted completely to trading. You know, it's a chapter where I just give my own personal observations about patterns and market action and suggest when certain things happen, you know, what you might want to do, and also the importance of keeping a log of your trading and stuff like that. So trading as the art of trading, if you will, is probably the main addition to new material. The options and spreads is really an update of what appeared in the original edition, going back to 1984.
Well, I have to hand it to you. You've definitely added a huge amount of content, and I was not expecting to learn anything reading the new version of the book when I received a courtesy copy from your publisher, but I did. There's quite a bit of new content there. Before I let you go, I would like to touch very briefly. We did a full interview with you back in March on your new project, Fundseeder. People who are interested in learning more about that are probably best to go listen to that entire interview, but just so they know what we're talking about, give us a really quick 30-second definition of what's Fundseeder.
Okay, so Fundseeder is a site where traders can go, put up their accounts, link their accounts to the site, and get all sorts of analytics, like generate an equity curve, generate all sorts of analytics on their trading. And the whole purpose of Fundseeder is to provide a central website to discover undiscovered trading talent globally. And our intention is to find traders who will link to the site, have demonstrated superior performance, regardless of where they might be, regardless of who they might know, regardless of what university they attended, but just have these accounts to demonstrate an ability to trade and to find these traders, and through a separate sister company, which is on the investment side, act as a link between those traders and investors looking to allocate to new trading talent, and also eventually to perform a fund of a multiple manager fund of these traders. So the idea is the traders get all this analysis for free, and they get the opportunity to be discovered and potentially manage money. And we're providing that because we're trying to find these traders and then link them with investors through a sister company, and therefore act as this sort of electronic third-party marketing venture. So that, in a nutshell, is Fundseeder. And it's that people can find it at fundseeder.com.
So if you are an aspiring actress wanting to be discovered in Hollywood, you should be sitting at a sidewalk cafe in front of Sunset Plaza on the Hollywood Strip. But if you are a trader wanting to be discovered and get a job or launch your own fund, you need to be discovered by sitting on fundseeder.com. And of course, we did do a full interview with Jack back in March about that subject. We are going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, Jack. I really appreciate it. Congratulations on the new book. Once again, folks, the book is called A Complete Guide to the Futures Market by Jack Schwager. It's available on Amazon. Be absolutely sure that you get the newly published second edition. And we're going to have to leave it there. Jack, thanks so much for a great interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
That was a great interview, Eric. I want to now circle back to the market wrap, where we wanted to discuss crude oil again. You said you had a few more thoughts you wanted to share with our listeners once they heard the interview with Jack Schwager before diving into the mechanics of how futures contracts work. What did you have in mind?
Well, what's on my mind, Patrick, I saw a couple of really interesting articles this week by John Kemp, who is an analyst for Reuters. The first one, he talks about a really huge increase in open interest in options on calendar spreads in crude oil futures contracts. Now, what the heck am I talking about? Let me explain that. What this bet is that a lot of hedge funds are putting on, because the Commitment of Traders reports really tells you what hedge funds are doing more than anybody everybody else. That's who make up most of the speculative trading interest. They're effectively using options to do it, expressing a view which is long the June futures contract in crude oil and short the December contract. So they think that the December price, which is currently higher than the June price, is going to be lower than the June price by the time that option expires around the 20th of May. Because, of course, the June delivery contract ends up being settled in May. It's delivery of oil in June, and the trading ends on the 22nd day of May. So why are they making that bet? The reason is they expect that the market will come into balance this year, and they believe that backwardation, which means longer-dated contracts are sold at a discount to nearer-dated contracts, will be the result of that. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, well before reading this article, I've been already on the opposite side of that trade. And frankly, reading this article just made me feel better about being on the opposite side of that trade. I am short the June contract and long the December contract because I see the exact opposite. So why is it that these people think that rebalancing is going to produce backwardation? The reason they think that is because when we get to the point where we're no longer producing more oil than we can consume and the market is in balance in terms of supply and demand, they think that the price for longer dated contracts is going to be pushed down. And I would say go back and read John Kemp's article if you want a little bit perspective on why they think that. I think they've got it completely wrong. They think that this has to do with supply and demand coming into balance. I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's about storage coming into balance. And the reason that I say that involves getting into a little bit of detail about the mechanics of how futures work. Now, we've gotten to the point now, and this is fascinating to me, that the very same guy, John Kemp, also the same week, wrote another article saying that we've, for the first time in recorded history, gotten to the point where there's almost 1 million contracts, that's 1 billion with a B barrels, or 42 billion with a B gallons of crude oil in terms of speculative long interest. That's adding Brent and WTI together. So speculators, mostly hedge funds, are long, net long, 1 million contracts, 1 billion barrels. Well, what happens is, unlike something like Apple stock, where people own it and they own it for the long haul and they don't think about selling it, every single one of those contracts has to be sold before the end of the month, every single month, because they have an expiration date. And unless you have a tank to put that oil in, you can't hold the contract beyond its last trading date. So they have to, all of these guys that are long these million contracts have to sell those million contracts before the month is over. Well, what are the commercials doing? Those are the people who are in the business, who own those big storage tanks and actually own the physical oil. Those guys are saying, hey, I have a huge competitive advantage here. The speculators, the hedge funds, they have to sell that contract. If they hold it past the end of the month, they're in big trouble. They have to sell it. I can hold out and I can say, you're going to sell it and you're going to sell it to me for a low price. I'm not going to offer a high price. Because the rules for how futures are settled say, the guy who's long on a speculative basis and doesn't have a tank to store the oil in, he has to sell by a certain date. So he's saying to the other guy, the short, who also has to close his position, look, you got to sell to me. You got to sell to me. The date's coming up. The deadline's tomorrow. For the guy who actually owns oil in a tank, he's saying, no, I don't have any deadline. I'm in the driver's seat, buddy. I am not going to buy from you for the price you want. I'm going to give you a lowball price. And the only way that I'm going to buy that contract back is if you give me a significant discount to what next month's price is. Because if I'm the guy that owns the storage tank, that's the way I make my money, is by being in the storage business. And if you don't want to give it to me, fine. I won't close my contract. I will just stay short. You won't be able to sell, and you'll have to take delivery. Oh, you don't have a tank for delivery, and I do have a tank. Well, guess what, buddy? You got to play by my rules. Now, how do they get away with that? They get away with that when they're able to control the market because there is a shortage of storage. If you had ample storage all over the country and nobody knew what to do with all the empty tank space, they wouldn't be able to play that game. My contention is that with Cushing at over 85% of capacity, they can play that game, and they can play that game well. And I think when we get to May 20th, when that options contract expires, it's going to expire worthless for all of those hedge funds that are buying it in massive size because they don't understand it's about storage. It's not about supply and demand. Now, if we get to the point where we actually burn through all of that oil and those tanks are not at 85% capacity, they're at 20% capacity, then I definitely think we're headed into backwardation. So I think that because of the mechanics of how this works, the commercials are going to be in a very good place. The hedge funds are going to get burned. And it's fascinating that the same guy wrote two different articles that, to me, are presenting very different contradictory information. And it's because of this massive long exposure that I think we could really see a big, big sell-off in crude oil. Once that gets going, what happens is it's hot money and all of the people that have bet long have bet too much. The price is going down and it's like a short squeeze in reverse. They've lost money. They're in a futures position they don't want to be in. They have to get into, I'll sell at any price. And now you get panic selling and the market sells off dramatically. I think that could be coming in the next few months. And it's not about fundamentals. It's about sentiment and about too much long exposure existing in the market at one time.
I couldn't agree more, Eric. The sentiment towards oil is so bullish. At some point, there's so much room for this to unwind.
Well, and as long as we're on the subject of crude oil, Patrick, I'd like to tap your knowledge of options trading again this week. Now, my view, as I described in the market wrap, is that this rally in crude oil is probably over. I emphasize the word probably. I don't think WTI is going north of 55 unless there's a geopolitical upset or Donald Trump proposes something crazy with ISIS. And at that point, anything could happen. So the way I see this is the risk of us going over 55 but not over 60 is very low. I think we either stay below 55 or we get to some geopolitical upset thing where, you know, you go way higher. So what can I do with options in order to make a buck from that view?
Well, Eric, with options, we can really approach this trade two ways. The most common way, which all traders at all levels understand, is to position yourself to profit from the actual anticipated directional move. But the other, less explored alternative is to profit in anticipating where the security, in this case oil, is not going to go. This is a powerful alternative way of investing because you don't have to be right about the price move occurring. Rather, to profit, you just have to be right about where it's not going to go. And so, obviously, our more sophisticated listeners already know where I'm going with this, and we're going to discuss the idea of using option credit spreads, not to be confused with bond credit spreads. In this case, if we were building that narrative around oil where we believe 55 will be a major overhead resistance and even a short-term rise may be short-lived up to 60 and then reverse back down, then we want to try to build a credit spread around that. Now, the first and more aggressive strategy is to create a credit spread between the $55 and $60 strikes. In this case, I'm going to use a more aggressive strategy of a little shorter term, and we'll go, let's say, 74 days out to the April 17th expiration. Right now, a 55-60 call credit spread is paying just under $2 on that $5 spread. What makes this obviously aggressive is that the short end of that call is right at the money, which means we can feel a little bit of heat on the trade if oil does break out above that 55 level.
Okay, Patrick. So I want to ask you about the trade management of a credit spread if the trade was to start to go against you. But first, what if an investor wanted a bit more breathing room? Let's say, rather than going right at the money, going a little bit higher on the strike price.
Right. The alternative and probably a far more conservative approach is to create a credit spread up in that $60 to $65 range. So for illustrative purposes, in this case, we're going to go, let's say, out 104 days to that May 17th options expiration. So the $60-$65 call credit spread pays just under a dollar for that $5 spread. And while there's more time and you're getting less credit, you now have the breathing room where oil could temporarily temporarily rally even as high as $60. And so long as it stays at 60 or less, you're still in a position to make the full profit.
So the first question we should ask is why it is that you're writing an option spread as opposed to just selling the call option naked. Now, when you just sell the call option naked, you'll have a much larger margin requirement, and more importantly, you'll have an undefined risk if the trade goes against you. Alternatively, with the call spread, your margin requirement is defined by the $5 spread. In other words, you know your maximum loss. It's not an open-ended thing. Patrick, what are the other advantages of doing it as a spread?
Well, Eric, one of the key advantages is the option Greeks. Because you're buying a call option to hedge the short option, you're netting out many of the variables like delta, theta, and vega, which are price, time, and volatility. So in this case, the short call has a negative delta, but the long call has a positive delta. Your spread is changing only at the net delta of the two options. What this does is calm the trade down, reducing the impact of big short-term swings.
Before we move on, how would you advise someone to manage this, particularly if the trade is moving against them? What are the risk management considerations?
In a trade like this, you must take one of two stances. First, you can take the no market timing approach, which simply is that you size the position with the maximum risk, in this case a $5 spread, as being an acceptable loss. Alternatively, if you utilize some form of market timing, you can cut out of the trade the moment you recognize the trade has soured. The benefit of the spread trade is that the only time the maximum loss can be reached is at expiration. So if you cut out of the trade weeks or even months early, you can often do it with a very reasonable and defined risk.
Now, just for our listeners who don't have a futures trading account, this strategy, I would assume, could be equally applicable to using the oil ETF, which is USO.
Exactly. The USO trades about one-fifth of the price of oil, which is right now around $11.50. So to replicate that zone of the $55 to $60 strikes, you would choose the $12 level on the ETF as roughly the same as $55 on oil. So you can, for instance, do a credit spread between $12 to $13 or $12 to $14 on the call spread, and you can do this in most standard trading accounts and get a very similar outcome.
Well, Patrick, before we close, I had hoped to have time to cover index straddles. That was a question that we got from a listener. It definitely relates to the market view that I expressed in the market wrap earlier. Unfortunately, we are past our time limit already. I really appreciate the excellent content you've given on this. I'll tell you what, let's hit that next week. We'll talk about option index straddles and how they can be used. And we want to continue to emphasize to our listeners that we appreciate your feedback. Please continue to tell us what you want. There's so much Patrick brings to the table. We're going to keep playing with these option strategies because that's what a few of you have asked for, but we definitely welcome other feedback. A few other things before we wrap up today's show. We definitely need your help with promoting the show. It really is helping. We've got a really big guest coming up next week, and we've got a few more lined up after that. So please retweet when you see our announcements. Tell your friends about Macro Voices. Forward your research roundups to your friends and colleagues. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered listeners we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best guests on the program. The benefit to you, of course, is you receive our free research roundup, which is a free weekly compendium of all of the best links to cool stuff that we could find on the internet for free each week. Patrick, give us the rundown. What can they expect in this week's research roundup?
Well, Eric, there's so much that's going to be coming out in that research roundup email. I just want to highlight four of the articles that are in there. The first one is the BP Energy Outlook by Spencer Dale. As well, Mr. Das put out a really amazing article talking about why inflation won't last. In addition to that, what was really interesting was on Spiegel Online, there was a great article talking about that Trump's attack on Germany and the global economy. As well, in the Telegraph, there was a great article written about the Eurozone destruction is necessary if countries are to thrive again. I thought that was really interesting. So that's included and so much more in this week's research roundup email. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all of the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, make sure you send it to us by email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow us on our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all of the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.